Hey, thank you everybody for joining us on this Sunday's episode of Nevada Backcountry. Couple things coming up. First and foremost, we'll talk a little bit about Pyramid Lake, fly fishing Pyramid Lake specifically. And then a relevant topic, we will get into a little bit about the effects a heavy winter can have on animal herds. So we'll go through that with David right out of the gate. Good to see you again, David.
Good to see you too, Henry.
So this is a little off the reservation, I'll say, no pun intended there, but instead of hunting specific or archery specific stuff, you and I talked about kind of covering Pyramid Lake.
Yeah.
I know you said you had some friends that have done really well out there lately.
Yeah, the last couple of weeks, a lot of my friends that have been going out there specifically on the ladders,
yep,
either fly fishing off the ladders or using spoons, they have been doing quite well. Granted, few of them have been catching some pretty nice size fish.
Oh, bigger fish.
Yeah, a few of them. But in general, they're catching the 15 to 20 inches or so pretty regularly, I guess.
Okay.
Just depending on what your definition of regularly is.
Yeah, Pyramid Lake can be like that. I'll go ahead and right off the bat, here's my disclaimer on this. I skipped, 4 or 5 years out there, and then recently have started going back out again in the last couple years. I am not an expert by any stretch of the imagination. So with that out of the way, I guess I should tag onto that too. You mentioned spoons. If it comes to boats on Pyramid Lake, gear fishing Pyramid Lake, I'm not the guy to talk to.
Oh, no. The last few years for me, it's just been recently, the last, I'd say, 2 or so years that I've actually gotten back into using a ladder. Fishing with a ladder. And I've been really enjoying that. But prior to that, good buddy of mine, grew up with him since we were kids, ended up with a really awesome boat. And I'll tell you, once you jump in a really nice boat and you've got the downriggers and you control and you can kick back and listen to music, you get spoiled. That consumed a few years for me, but now I'm getting back into the ladders and I'm really digging it again.
Are you gear fishing or fly fishing?
I'm fly fishing.
Okay.
There's that, like they say, hey, it's just like riding a bike. No.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
And even though you're fishing for trout, it's not your traditional. I would equate it more to saltwater style fishing. And the reason I say that is you're throwing heavier lines, bigger, 7, 8, 9 weight rods in some instances.
Yeah.
Punching into the wind.
Yeah. Nice long rods. So you got some good flexibility there. At least that's what I've been told. And so that's what I've been purchasing. And a lot of the folks that I've gone with, they may have, I found their fly rods. They may have 3 or 4 different fly rods with different weighted lines, from lead cores to some of them use floating line, depending on where the fish are hitting or how they're reacting to some of this stuff. But me, I use my old school, I call them Vegas showgirls.
Okay.
I coined that name a long time ago because they were, these larger flies with these long tails on them.
God, it's a Vegas showgirl.
Yeah, this thing looks like a Vegas showgirl. So I've been using those, and primarily in like olive colors, some of the darker earth tone colors, and been doing really, really well with those.
Let's back up real quick. Yeah. I wanted to touch on John C. Fremont makes it to Oregon on this expedition. The Dalles, I believe, is where they made it to. That was in 1843. Everybody says, okay, job's done. We're going back to Washington. We've mapped what we had to map. John C. Fremont says, yeah, no, I'm good. I'm going to explore the Great Basin. This was, he wasn't on the payroll anymore. His job was done. He took it upon himself to cross the Sierra Nevadas in the middle of winter, makes it to the Great Basin, and comes upon the tribes and Pyramid Lake. Named it Pyramid Lake. I won't say discovered. People get touchy about that. Obviously, when you have native tribes that have been there for something like 9,000 years, he didn't discover it, but he was certainly the first European to set eyes on it, map it, and name it. So That's the little bit of history on Pyramid Lake, a very unique ecology. I remember I went to it was a Truckee River fly fisher banquet. Dennis Isbister, Wild Fish, Wild Places, a Fallon guy, had that TV show, I think it was. He talked about how cool it is to have a lake like this in our backyard. The next closest thing on the planet would be something like Jurassic Lake down in Argentina, very alkaline lake, higher salt content, but it produces enormous trout. The Lahontan cutthroat trout is a species of trout in there. There's a couple subspecies. Now, going into fishing the lake, I'm like you. I'm a fly fisherman. I've never gear fished the lake, to be quite honest. Don't know anything about that, but I wanted to touch on, I brought it up a couple minutes ago, the setup stuff for Pyramid Lake. It's extremely unique. Leave the 4 and 5 weight trout sticks at home. Bring the big guns, 8, 9 weight rods in some instances. And a lot of the time, it's not necessarily the size of the fish, like you talked about your friends getting into those smaller 20-inch fish or so. It's not necessarily the size of the fish. It's the sheer fact that a lot of times you're having to punch into the wind to cast. That's what I run out there. Now, you mentioned the longer rods. Your friend's running switch rods out there, the 11 and a half foot.
Yeah, 11 and a half foot, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. I know those have become super popular. I might be an outlier on this. I love switch rods, baby spay for swinging steelhead, that sort of thing. Out at Pyramid, though, man, it's a nightmare trying to land a fish with an 11 and a half foot rod.
Oh, yeah. It's also fun, though. I mean, when you get into something, you know, there's that whole challenge, not challenge, but the feels like at times that you've got yourself a 15-pound fish on there because that pole just reacts so
very
to
true.
Every movement. So that's kind of exciting. You know, granted, when you do get it in and it's 15 inches, you're like, huh. Okay. But still, you know, I've got one myself and I've noticed that there is definitely a specific technique you need to not technically master, but be pretty proficient with so that you're not snapping flies off. I snapped off plenty of flies because I wasn't allowing the flow, that nice natural fly fishing flow through your casting cycle. And I was, you know, with that 11-foot rod, I was pulling too hard and just, you could hear that, like, whipping snap. And you're like, oh, dang it.
Part of that is starting your forward cast too early, not letting the rod load on the back end. So, again, I see the value, I guess, of a two-handed rod, a baby spay or a switch rod out there at Pyramid. I run just standard 9-foot, 8-weight, throwing those big shooting heads. I can keep a tighter loop. I can punch into the wind. And when you do get something, you're not trying to wrestle it at the end of an 11-and-a-half-foot rod.
Right. Bring it in.
Yep. You can land it and get it. If you've got a longer net, you can get it in the net by yourself. You don't need assistance. So that's why I tend to lean towards those single-handed rods for Pyramid.
Yeah. Well, and then you get into the ladders there, and you've seen some of these
contraptions.
Oh, some of them, man. It's like, wow, you really thought that through. There's a guy next to me a couple weeks ago who, the only thing he was missing on this thing was like a motor.
Yeah.
I mean, he wheeled.
Cup holders and everything.
Yeah. It had a cooler. He had a cooler on the back of it. It had a swivel like chair on it. I don't know. It may have retracted. I'm not sure. Reclined or something. But when he wheeled that thing out, I was like, dude, he's here for the duration.
Yeah. In it for the long haul.
Yeah. So, I mean, mine's just an 8-foot Werner standard fiberglass ladder with some
braces
and some PVC pipe attachments to hold the basket and some other things like that. And that's it. I'm mobile. All right. So coming up after the break, we will be getting into a little bit more of the Pyramid Lake fishing. Stay tuned. We will be right back. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for staying tuned on Nevada Backcountry. We're going to get ourselves right back into talking about Pyramid Lake fishing.
Yeah, where we left off there, David, we started to get into the ladder thing a little bit. I've fished off the ones you sit down. It's a big welded steel contraption. Those are certainly way more comfortable. Got a little casting platform and everything, but they suck for hauling through the sand. You mentioned you saw somebody with like wheelbarrow tires on theirs.
This was the one I was telling you about. It looked like he was there for the duration. He had wheelbarrow tires attached to it, and he just leaned it back and wheeled it out there and then brought it up onto its upright position. And then the backside had a little ladder style. It looks like it was welded and built and had a platform, had the chair, it had a little cooler on it. Pretty awesome, but quite an elaborate setup compared to probably everybody else that was on the beach that day.
Yeah, those are great. Depending on what beach you are fishing, those can be a nightmare to drag through the sand, over rocks, et cetera, et cetera. The fiberglass thing with some bracing is probably a better call.
A lot more mobile, because those bigger ones, yeah, you're right. I mean, granted, a lot of the Pyramid Lake is a sandy bed, but yep, there are certain spots that are really good fishing during certain times of the year. And it's not, you go out for a little bit of sand and then you're going to get into some rocks and such.
Getting into that, certain beaches, certain times of the year, I wanted to touch a little bit on the techniques or how to find fish, where to go. Generally, I'm going to paint with a really broad brush here, but generally, if you've got wind in your face and you know the bottom topography of the beach you're fishing, if you've got a really steep drop-off within casting distance and you've got wind in your face, those bait balls, the toy chub, little bait fish that the trout feed on out there, those are going to get pushed up against that drop-off. So that is a perfect spot to set up. Wind in your face, steep drop-off. And I'll touch a little bit on the techniques. I am not an indicator guy. I'll do it if it produces fish, but generally, again, really broad brush, what I have found is the indicator thing, and by indicator I mean bobber. I won't church it up. Everybody's seen it, some of the foam stick-ons up to the bigger, they call them thingamabobbers, that you screw on to the leader. But that can produce big numbers of fish. I've never caught big fish doing the indicator thing. I know a lot of people do. I tend to do better with a shooting head, sinking line, and stripping the traditional Pyramid Lake setup, like a woolly worm, and about 3 feet off the back of it, the famous popcorn beetle.
Popcorn beetle, yeah.
Yep. That produces bigger fish for me.
Yeah, I'm pretty much like you. I'm not really good with the indicator myself, but I have a hard time with casting into the wind.
Okay.
I really like watching folks that are good at it, because it is super cool to watch how they can cut that wind. I probably need to take some classes at Reno Fly Shop or somebody that knows how to do it and can give me some pointers on how to properly cast into the wind.
And that's back to my point about being like saltwater fishing almost. That saltwater environment where you're casting, you've got to make a 75, 80-foot cast. You got to keep a tight loop. You've got to be able to punch into the wind. Those saltwater skills translate perfectly to Pyramid Lake. And that could be my reluctance with the switch rod thing, too, is I'm much better with a single-handed rod. Getting into that a little bit, the sink tip stuff, you know, a lot of people like those full sink or a graduated, I believe Scientific Anglers makes one where it's like a first 30 feet is sink 5. And what that means is it basically sinks at 5 inches per second. Then it goes into like a sink 3 to an intermediate running line. I don't like that stuff for Pyramid Lake. I understand the concept behind it and the theory, but those old school teeny style where it's a full heavy sink head to a floating running line, I think the way that kind of makes your whatever fly you're using jig through the water column, I think those produce better results, or at least in my experience. Another thing I wanted to touch on when it comes to Pyramid Lake, I've got a closet full of them. They're great for rivers and warm weather, chasing smaller trout in the summer, but leave the breathable waders at home.
Geez, yeah.
It's
yeah.
Bring out the duck hunting waders, the neoprene stuff, couple pairs of thick socks. Pyramid Lake is one of those places where the warmer you dress, the longer you'll fish, the longer you'll stay out there, the better the success rate. And I've made that mistake before, going out there in like the Sims breathable waders.
Yeah.
Thinking, well, I'm trout fishing.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. When you're talking about water temps out there, wind in your face, winter conditions, storms generally move fish around. It's a better time to fish. Wear the thicker neoprene waders. Don't go out in breathables.
Yeah, no. Knees down end up getting pretty numb.
Oh, knees, everything. Yeah, it's a unique experience for sure.
I mean, you can always throw some other stuff in your rig and go change out if you start getting too hot or something, but definitely start out with the heavier gear. So when you do head out to Pyramid Lake and you're driving out there, how do you know which way to go? How do you know if you're going to head out towards Pelican? Are you going to drop off right and head down towards Popcorn? And what is your indicator?
Wind direction.
Wind direction. So you always want the wind in your face.
Yes, and that's something I learned from that. Specifically, a guy I fish with, we can get into the whole old annual license thing versus now it's just the daily fee thing.
Yeah, I really miss the annual license thing.
Yeah, that was $86 sweet. Bucks or something?
Yeah, I think the most, at that last year, I think it was like 94 or something, which was perfect. I mean, it was great, better than...
And then you don't feel like you got to sit out there and suffer all day. But a guy I started fishing Pyramid with again kind of taught me this. Windfinder, I think it's windfinder.com. It will show you the direction of winds on the lake. You can zoom in, see Pyramid Lake. That would be your deciding factor when you're looking at where to fish. The old kind of, I heard from a friend of a friend, they're getting good fish at this beach, that beach, that grapevine effect. It goes far and wide. 9 times out of 10, you'll show up at that beach. It'll be packed. It'll be a nightmare situation. I call it combat fishing, basically.
Oh, yeah.
You're muscling for position on the beach versus look at the direction of the wind. That will tell you where to fish. Those will be the better beaches, the one where you have that onshore wind coming at you. That would be the, this is where I'm going to go based on the wind.
So that might be the reason why I generally don't catch a ton. You know, I'm not posting pictures like some folks are with these. Because me, I'm like, well, I don't want the wind in my face because...
The casting thing?
Yeah, because I'm not a great in-the-wind caster. Maybe that's where I need to get some advice and figure out how to do that because I'm generally the opposite. I'm like, well, I'm going to go somewhere where the wind is kind of neutral or maybe a little bit in my back, but... What you had stated before makes a lot of sense that, the feeder fish are going to be pushed up against the edges. And I mean, that completely makes sense to me now.
Yes,
I better start learning.
Work on your cast, learn to cast into the wind. And it's definitely more miserable because you get those waves. And as you know, I guess we probably should have talked a little bit about safety factors at Pyramid. But man, when that wind picks up and you're talking about 2-3 foot waves crashing over you, it can be extremely dangerous. You know, there are people out there all the time. I see them in those little, like a caddis inflatable float tube thing.
Yeah, I don't know what they're thinking.
No,
especially when it's windy and it starts to white cap.
Get off the lake.
Ever since I was a kid, that was the one rule I was always told or taught. You see white caps, get off the water.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't matter if you're on a ladder or anything. You start seeing white caps, it's time to pack up.
More people drown in Pyramid Lake than just about anywhere else in the state.
Yeah. I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, it seems
like every summer I hear there's another news story about that. Yeah. Somebody
We're not
drowned.
Trying to tell people not to go there because it's a fantastic place, but
no,
be
I am.
Safe,
stay
man.
Away.
Stay away. Yeah, especially stay away from my beach.
Yeah. No, I mean, anywhere else in the world, you know, you'd have condos, resorts, et cetera. Yeah. I know Ted Turner famously fishes it pretty regularly. I kind of like the dysfunction of that where it is, kind of keeps that stuff out of there.
But it's mysterious because, you could be out there. So this happened to us years ago. A friend of mine and I, we were in an aluminum boat. and we're fishing. It was nice out. All of a sudden, within moments, it got nasty. And with that little aluminum boat with a 9.9 horsepower motor, we could not get back to shore. So we just turned the boat around before the thing, you know, either flipped or sunk or what, because we had water coming in. And we ended up having to run the thing up on the beach about 2.5 or so miles from where we had parked the truck.
Oh, geez.
Because there was just, and then we just had to hunker down and wait.
Hey, reason number 856 to fish from a ladder. If you got a bail, it's a 20-yard walk.
Very true.
Coming up after the break, let's get into the effects of a heavy winter on animal populations, on herd disbursement. Stay tuned to Nevada Backcountry. Welcome back to the show. Friendly reminder, we are giving away a full year of the Mountain Tough Plus package, courtesy of David. So to enter into that, all you've got to do, like, subscribe on Facebook, drop us a comment, let us know what you want to hear us talk about in upcoming segments and shows, and we will pick one winner from that for the Mountain Tough Plus program. We'd also like to thank Out West Buildings out in Fallon for sponsoring the show today. Now, David, this is one of those things. Everybody's watching it. It seems like we get a break for a day or two, then I'm back to staring at snowflakes coming down. This is a good one. We're having a really heavy winter right now. I wanted to pick your brain on some of the animal behavior, how they survive a really, really heavy winter like the one we're having currently.
Certain groups of animals will go into what's called a torpor. Others will go into a hibernation state. Reptiles ruminate. It's a way of dealing with extreme colds. Now, torpor, an animal can go in and out of torpor based on their environment and the cold survival strategies that they need to get them through the winter. So it's something that they can go in and out of. And that's, you know, you'll see that in birds, bats, and some small mammals.
Okay, field mice, stuff like that.
Yeah, you'll see other animals like flying squirrels and chipmunks and stuff. They'll get into bigger groups, and they'll use each other's body warmth to Yeah, basically create, to maintain a good temperature. They'll get into a nice cavity, a tree cavity or a rock cavity or what have you, and they can group up.
And I'm assuming they're slowing their heart rate or they're doing
Correct.
Something. They're not burning a lot of calories doing this.
No, not at all. I mean, their big thing, all animals during the winters, is to conserve energy.
Right.
That is the one thing, that's the big thing that will create, you know, or cause death, is the loss of too much energy too fast and not being able to get that back.
Okay, so this torpor that mm-hmm. some species go into, how long, it's like a micro hibernation. How long does this last?
It can last a few hours. It can last several days. It is a state where the body just goes into it. It slows its body
metabolism
down. You know, it maintains its internal core body temperature is the focus of a torpor. Then you go into the hibernation. Now, hibernation is, everyone's heard about hibernation. And the most common animal is the bear. So this is another one. It reduces metabolic activity of the animal, and it lowers its body temperature and its breathing rates. And this is triggered by a change in its hormones that is linked to the diminishing lengths of the days. Hibernation is long term. They'll go into hibernation and they'll be there for months.
Do they know what spurs that? I think, okay, deer in the rut and everything, and kind of based on amount of light during the day and how long that is. And what triggers hibernation? Is it something similar? Is it an environmental stimulus or is it just
the environmental? As our days get shorter and we get closer to winter, the approach of winter, that's the trigger. That's that hormonal shift in the animal that's telling it to start focusing on finding a good den or good location.
Okay, so similar to like a rut that causes that increase in testosterone in bucks and all that.
Correct.
Okay.
Those are the main three to help them survive extreme winters. Now, the winter we're having now, you know, we're getting a lot of snow, a lot of cold days. The other animals, you know, we're talking elk, deer, antelope, a lot of the ungulates, they will change their behavior by moving to different habitats to guard against the extremes of cold temperatures. You can see them getting away from exposed open grasslands and moving themselves into a forested area, helping them get away from the wind. They can be migrating from higher elevations to lower elevations, a windy mountainside or a slope, and staying away from the shaded areas and getting into areas where it's more sunny, more sun exposure.
Those southern-facing aspects.
Yeah. So these are changes that wildlife will make to avoid the cold temperatures. So,
do they self-regulate at all as far as available food sources? And by that, I mean, will they stay in a big herd if they don't have a ton of available forage, or will they break off into smaller groups?
So food isn't like their primary focus during the winter months.
Okay.
One of their biggest things is their fat content. They've got a nice buildup of fat that they've built up during the spring and the summertime. That is their focus. They are trying to save as much energy as possible. They kind of like a really super chill lifestyle.
Jazzercises out.
Correct. So they can expend as little energy as possible to get them through those extremely cold days. One of the big things that does increase the risk of animals dying is the depth of the snow. You know, having to trudge through that big, heavy, tall snow, and they've got to, you know, kind of leap in and out of it to get through it, they're expending a great deal of energy. They're burning those fat reserves and they're burning the proteins. So their fat, it's like if you put on a big old parka and go outside, you're going to be good. You go out without the parka and in your t-shirt, you're going to be cold. So as they're burning this off and they're expending that energy and burning all that fat, they're going to end up getting colder and they will higher probability of freezing and starving.
I'll tell you, if you'll allow me to sidebar for a minute, throw away your farmer's almanac. If you're sitting there trying to look at a farmer's almanac and figure out what kind of winter we're going to have, toss that sucker. Go talk to a taxidermist. Mike Nelson, who you and I both know, Mike's doing my dad's sheep. I think he's doing your sheep as well.
Yep.
Mike and I had this conversation back during my dad's sheep hunt, and he called it. He made the comment that every animal that had come into his shop this year had a super thick layer of fat on them. You know, we were kind of sitting around BSing, glassing for sheep. He was out there actually on that sheep hunt with my dad. But we were talking about this, and he made the comment. He said, yeah, based on every animal that's come into the shop, it's going to be a really heavy winter. I saw that again, the buck that a friend of mine, his dad killed up there in 062, super thick layer of fat on it. My deer, super thick layer of fat on it. So the animals know something we don't. They definitely knew there was a heavy winter coming based on the amount of fat they had on them.
Yeah.
Thanks. Hey, thanks for allowing the sidebar.
No worries. No, that's good stuff.
Yeah, no. So, hey, if you want to know what type of winter we're going to have, go see a taxidermist. Ask him how much fat the animals have had on them coming into the shop.
Yeah, because that fat's really important for their survival going into the winter. So another high risk element for them is harassment. So that could be from predators or from us, from humans, pushing the animals during the winter seasons. This can detrimentally affect deer, elk, sheep, antelope, and stuff, trying to live that kind of chilled out lifestyle during the winter. By making them burn, you're basically putting them at a higher risk of not surviving the winter. So it's not necessarily the quality of their winter forage that guarantees the winter survival. It is rather the body's mass going into the winter that is the most important survival tool that our animals will have in even extreme years like this, where we've got a prolonged winter, lots of snow, a lot of cold days, and it doesn't seem to really stop. We have to remember they've been doing this for thousands of years. These animals have figured out how to adapt to these changing conditions, anywhere from a weak winter to extremely cold, heavy winters. For females, quality of food in the spring and early summer habitats determines how big they will be heading into the winter, how much fat reserve, how much fat that they'll put on going into the winter months. Now, for males, their quality of forage in the habitats that they're occupying are primarily right after the rut. That habitat will determine how well their fat reserves will build and how well they're going to get through the winter. So this is a great indicator showing us that just because you see a herd of animals out there and they're all feeding and they're all doing their thing in that particular location, that particular time of year might be only benefiting the females and the offspring. And it's not that particular area is not benefiting the males at the time because they're getting ready to go into the rut.
I just learned something. Yeah, I didn't know that. I always tend to think of it like from a herd perspective, but that makes sense when they're, you know, all rutted out and they've been fighting for 2-3 weeks straight.
Yeah, they're just doing nothing but burning energy because they're not eating very much at all during that time period because they're defending their herd.
And yeah, okay.
So they're burning. After the rut, they might be down to like little to no fat at all. So they have a very short window to pack that fat on to get them through the winter months.
So an earlier, heavier winter can be detrimental to bucks, basically, or the males of the species.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You just said early winter, right? Like a really early, October.
So, yeah, if we get hit in October.
Yeah, completely. That will primarily affect your bucks. The ones that are just getting done with the rut and trying to pack it on, they're the ones that are going to be at highest risk out of the herd to not make it through the winter.
Gotcha. Okay. Hey, you learn something new every week. Coming up after the break, we'll get into a little more of heavy winter effects on animals, species by species, maybe. Just keep it tuned to Nevada Backcountry and 99.1, 92.3 FM Talk.
Thank you for staying tuned with us on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Shout out to Out West Buildings, who is our sponsor for this show. Go visit them or check them out online. They are out of Fallon, Nevada, and they build a fantastic storage unit.
Over the break there, David, we were kind of chatting about some of the unique ways, you know, we touched on mammals, touched on reptiles. What about waterfowl?
Waterfowl, how they can kind of keep that warm body temperature, the core temperature, they have a heat exchange within their own system. So they've got warm blood coming out of the heart right next to where the cooler blood is going into the heart. And that warmer blood coming out exchanges its heat with the cooler blood going into the heart, basically heating that blood. So they've got continuous warm blood flowing through the system. It's a constant regulation of warm blood running through the body, keeping that core temperature nice and warm.
On that note, waterfowl specifically and people watching ducks and geese out on the ice. In fact, there's a guy in my neighborhood. He's always throwing out grain. Birds come in. He's feeding animals all winter. I've also seen the bad bowl cut, cargo short, and keen shoes crowd feeding horses, feral horses, during the winter. I think that comes from that kind of natural, like, hey, look at these poor freezing animals. I should be feeding them. And I'm guessing your vote on this is not just no, but hell no.
There's a lot of research going into feeding of wildlife. And first off, the feral horses, they're not wildlife. They are feral horses. They're probably used to being fed by somebody coming out to the pen,
right,
tossing some hay or grain in there. So they're kind of out of the equation.
Gotcha.
The empathy of people, it's nice to see that people have a worry for the wildlife. We do have to remember they've been around here a long time, thousands of years, doing what they're doing. We know what we're doing in an asphalt concrete jungle.
Yes, very true.
We do not know how things roll out in the forest or out in the plains or grasslands and stuff where these animals are. So,
and I'm assuming you can do more damage to a herd or to a flock or whatever by feeding them than if you just left them alone and left them to their own devices, correct?
Oh, most definitely. So supplemental feeding of wildlife typically does more harm than good, primarily to the ungulates. Most wildlife, their seasonal changes and their behaviors are adapting themselves to the cold. And just because you're feeding them and you see them eating does not mean you're helping them out. I mean,
right.
There's no guarantee that that caloric intake is what they're getting from whatever you're tossing out for them. It could also be affecting their digestive system. A lot of these animals aren't used to alfalfa or the grains you feed your horses. And most of the wildlife supplemental feeding will cause issues with energy conservation for these animals is key to surviving winter. And them doing stuff to where they are having to expend more energy than they regularly would increases the risk of them not making it through winter. So when you feed the animals, you're causing a unfamiliar congregation of wildlife into an unnaturally high density. These things can attract predators and increase the risk of death by predators or domestic animals.
Well, and I would think, too, the communicable diseases and stuff. Like I think of the sheep pneumonia problem. When you're getting all of these animals, condensing them into one specific feeding spot, all that transmissible illness stuff is going to go through the roof.
Exactly. And that was another thing I was going to bring up is, the spread of diseases among wildlife is going to go up quite a bit. I mean, rumen acidosis in deer, that'll kill them. And then you're also, causing a competition for the food that is basically on the ground for them, and it's wasting vital energy reserves and potentially leading to, injury and death.
Right.
Obviously, the big one is it reduces the fat reserves that the wildlife need to make it through the rest of the winter. So as you're feeding them, they're not maintaining that fat reserve. Okay, so they may have a nice full belly. They're not maintaining the fat. Now they're being more active. Now they're moving about more.
Oh,
so now you're
okay.
Putting them at risk of basically freezing to death because now they don't have that fat layer. And it's usually the brown fat, which is the one that has the highest of insulation, the highest in energy and caloric densities.
When you say brown fat, I think of the caul fat or what surrounds organs. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. They may have a full belly, but they're going to die of freezing to death.
Because you've created an unnatural caloric expense that they didn't have.
You are now basically domesticating them to some degree, and they will become used to coming to this particular location to be fed.
Okay,
so there's the caloric movement of that going back and forth from where they feel safe and sheltered up in the mountains to coming down, and then they're expecting it. So then now you start getting into the possibilities of human-wildlife conflicts. So everybody thinks it's all fine and dandy and so pretty to watch a herd of deer or elk or moose
in a neighborhood
or what have you feeding in their little local park there because Joe Schmo threw a whole bunch of bales of hay and they're there. And they become habituated to that type of behavior and it's established. It's very hard to break.
As you're saying that, I'm picturing that the south end of town there, the Veterans Parkway extension.
Yeah.
And how many animals you see hit on that. You talk about a harmful or a negative human wildlife interaction. Man, if you're luring them into a neighborhood to feed and they have to cross a major roadway, winding up through someone's windshield is a pretty harmful interaction, in my opinion.
Completely. And that is another risk, is them having to cross these roads and wandering through these neighborhoods to get to these locations that they've been basically groomed to go to. And as a hunter and a conservationist, understanding that wildlife must persevere through winter is not a source of concern for me. It's more of a source of fascination and appreciation for the resiliency. If you're out there and you're feeling like you need to feed animals and you know better than thousands of years of genetic makeup and their body's ability to make these very minor shifts to save energy and such, I would hope that you would listen to us and maybe take a different approach to this. I mean, if you want to help wildlife have the best chance of surviving the winters, the best thing you can do is get involved in protecting your public lands so that the most critical winter habitats are looked after in a way that puts the needs of wildlife and habitat first.
Couldn't have put it better myself and completely agree. If I could geek out on mule deer for a minute, that's one of the biggest detriments to mule deer is expansion, taking up traditional migration corridors and everything. And as much as I like to think I spend a fair bit of time in the backcountry out there, you know, the reality is I'm a tourist. You know, I may go out there for 6-7 days, but I ain't living out there.
Yeah.
And I might think I know what's best for these animals. I'm a conservationist. I'm a tourist in their backyard. And me thinking that I'm going to, you know,
save them
is just completely asinine.
Like you and I, we may go out in the backcountry and we may run into some nasty weather, might start snowing on us and such. We get in our trucks and we go home.
It doesn't even have to be weather. Like the show last week, man, it can be the mountain house gut brick and I'm out of there.
Exactly. And you're gone. These animals have adapted over thousands of years to deal with either warm winters or extremely cold, frigid winters that last a significantly longer period of time than our calendar has told us for the last couple hundred years. You know what I mean? So moose have adapted to cold weather environments. So when you have a really warm winter, moose are a higher risk of survival because they're used to extreme cold conditions due to their body mass and how their body functions. I mean, they build, their skin gets thicker. Moose and bisons, they can deal with this extreme cold. When you see those really cool pictures of a bison out in the plains.
Icicles hanging off its face.
It's got 5 inches of snow on it. And you're just like, how are they doing that? It's because they've adapted to it. Once it starts getting closer to the winter months, and that's generally the hormonal, like we were talking about, the shifts, their body starts to generate what it needs to. And if they don't, that's just nature. Things have to die.
Best thing you can do for them, leave them alone. Don't feed them.
And don't forget to subscribe and to like so that you can get into the drawing to receive the Mountain Tough Plus 1-year subscription.
Stay tuned. Coming up at 11 after the break here, it'll be Tom Gresham's Gun Talk. Hey, and thanks to our show sponsor, Out West Buildings in Fallon. If you're anything like me, you've gotten the enough is enough speech from your significant other. Before you go out and do something foolish this season, get in touch with my guy, Irvin. He's got plenty of man cave options to protect those priceless mounts and might even help save your marriage along the way. Just go to outwestbuildings.com.